So, well, this, my presentation is on confined space hazards. Confined space accidents occur with low frequency, but the consequences are severe. And over the past few years, this gives you an idea of the number of confined space accidents we've had in California. What this graph doesn't tell you is that 60% of the fatalities are rescuers involved in trying to extricate employees from the confined spaces. And here are a few of the incidents that we've had in California. The first incident involved two brothers. One was attempting to rescue the other brother in a confined space. The second incident, which occurred in Fullerton, also involved rescuers. And the third case that happened to be my investigation involved three employees. The first one was killed, and the second two were rescuers. The second rescuer ended up in a persistent vegetative state. And all of these employers had deficient confined space programs. In some cases, they didn't have any program whatsoever. So what is a confined space? We define a confined space. It's defined under Title VIII, California Code of Regulations, Section 5158, and 5157. This is the definition actually under 5157, which mirrors the federal standard, 29 CFR 1910.146. Large enough so an employee can enter and perform work in the area. And for entry, even if an employee can reach into the area but not actually physically enter the area with the rest of their body, we would consider that an entry. It has limited means for access or egress, and it's not designed for continuous occupancy. The definition under 5158 is slightly different, but it's similar. Under 5158, the existing ventilation in the space is not adequate to make the space safe, and that access and egress is difficult into and out of the space. These are some of the typical confined spaces, and of course there are atypical confined spaces too. And 5157 does not apply to construction work or agricultural or shipbuilding, but these are some typical confined spaces. And what is a permit-required confined space? A permit-required confined space has all the characteristics of confined space that we previously discussed, but it also has one or more of the following characteristics. It may contain a hazardous atmosphere. It may engulf an entrance, such as a grain silo with an engulfing product. It has an internal configuration which makes it difficult for an employee to extricate himself from the space, or it has another recognized health or safety hazard. It could be one which we will discuss in the next slides. Now, under 5157, the employer is to evaluate their spaces to determine if they actually have permit-required confined spaces or confined spaces that are not permit-required. And if the employer does have confined spaces, they're to identify the spaces with signage so the employees are aware of the locations and aware that the spaces are confined spaces. Now, if the employer decides that employees will not enter the spaces, they have to take effective measures to ensure that the employees will not enter the spaces. And for the division, that's becomes problematic because often employers will place signs on the confined spaces and say, well, that's an effective measure to prevent entry. But in our experience, we found that often a sign is not an effective measure to prevent entry into a permit-required confined space. Now, if employees will enter the confined spaces, the employer needs to develop a comprehensive program for confined space entry. And these are some of the elements of the program. And without going to all of them, I encourage everyone to review Title 8, Section 5156 through 5158. Or if you're in a state with a federal program, 29 CFR 1910.146. And these are all elements to evaluate the confined spaces. And the rescue component is a critical component, because we find employers who have programs, but they have no rescue component. And once an employee enters an atmosphere that's an asphyxiating atmosphere, the employee only has perhaps 4 minutes before they sustain serious brain damage. And so part of having a rescue component, it might be self-rescue on the part of the entrant, or it might be non-entry rescue, or it may be on-site rescue. But we find employers who, their rescue component is calling 911, or it's calling the fire department, and of course it's too late. And by the time rescuers arrive on scene, we usually have rescuers who are on-site who were untrained as rescuers in the confined space, and it becomes a body recovery with multiple victims in the confined space. And of course, to prevent entry into confined spaces is of course preferred, but the use of physical barriers is certainly preferred over the use of signage. These are some of the hazards in confined spaces: atmospheric hazards, the physical configuration. There being a mechanical hazard in the space, such as an agitator, other obstacles within the confined space. There may be electrical hazards, because often there are motors and equipment in the confined spaces. Sometimes there's engulfment hazards, as in grain silos that sort of confined space. And these are some of the atmospheric hazards that we encounter. Oxygen deficient atmospheres obviously can result in unconsciousness when someone enters in a hypoxic environment. Oxygen enriched atmospheres, of course, are dangerous because they'll promote ignition if there's a hydrocarbon present in the space and there's a source of ignition. And toxic atmospheres present their own problems, and asphyxiating atmospheres. In the case that we had in LA with that pharmaceutical company, it was an asphyxiating atmosphere where they had a simple asphyxiant present in the atmosphere. It was nitrogen, and it displaced the oxygen in the air. So oxygen and and argon, any simple asphyxiant, of course, is a problem. And chemical asphyxiants such as carbon monoxide can also be a problem in these kind of spaces. And of course, this is the classic triad, an oxidizer, a flammable gas or vapor, and some source of ignition, which might be the result of an activity going on in the space. And these are some examples of activities which may result in a toxic atmosphere. And here are some examples of causes for oxygen deficient atmospheres. Bacterial action, consumption of oxygen by rust, oxidation, bacterial action, and the physical configuration of the space. Now, under both the federal standard and our standard, if the space is 5 feet or deeper, there has to be a retrieval system attached to the employee so that the employee can be retrieved with a non-entry method. And what we've seen is they'll often have lanyards on the employees, but no mechanical means of retrieving the employee from the space. And here's some other hazards. And actually, under the federal standards for a confined space containing a chemical, if there's a chemical residue in the space, the space may not be reclassified as a non-permit required confined space. And that's the other place where we see problems, because permit required confined spaces under Title VIII and under the federal standard can be reclassified as non-permit required confined spaces, or there is a provision for alternate entry under Title VIII, Section 5158C5, or 5157C5, and this is where we see employers getting into trouble, because the space will be reclassified, employees will enter, but there's no rescue component because the employer has decided that employees never enter permit-required confined space. They enter a space after it's been reclassified. And so they'll enter the space, and when they do enter the space, it truly is a permit-required confined space, yet the employer has no rescue component to their confined space program. In that case, we end up going out and, you know, it becomes a fatality investigation. So these are some of the basic methods to implement a program, and there has to be training on the PPE and rescue equipment, and there has to be practice trainings, I believe, every 12 months. And as I discussed before, harnesses and a mechanical means to extricate the employees from the spaces if they're 5 feet or deeper. Not simply a lanyard, because a lanyard really does no good if there's no mechanical means to extricate the person from the space. And you know, if there are any questions, sure. Go ahead. Well, which case are we talking about in particular? Well, they're all on appeal, all the cases from 2011. So, you know, the division's policy is not to comment on cases under appeal. But I can tell you, you know, with these Fortune 500 companies, they have extensive confined space plans. But the way the plans are constituted, the employer will say, well, we've made an election not to have employees enter a permit-required confined space. And truly, that's, you know, we find that's not the case. And when they try to do impromptu rescues of employees in confined spaces, and management's usually involved in organizing the rescues, even at that point, at least from the standpoint of a regulator, we take that as management knowledge that they intended to enter the confined space. So having a partial program with missing elements and taking the position that you don't enter the space, you know, and the space is reclassified, or you're doing alternate entry under 5157C, you know, C5, or you're doing reclassification under 5157C7, you know, it's simply inadequate, because once the person enters the space and the space is truly not reclassifiable, now you have an employee entering a permit-required confined space, yet you have no rescue component. So as a regulatory, you know, person, when we find that, you know, from our point of view, it's inexcusable, especially with a Fortune 500 company. I mean, that pharmaceutical manufacturer, that one plant, their annual sales is $3.5 billion a year out of that single plant. And, you know, for me, money is not an object, at least for that employer. There's no reason to have a program that's missing elements.
Go ahead.
Sure. Well, what is the most common issue with confined spaces? From my point of view, the most common issue with the confined spaces is improper reclassification of permit-required confined spaces as non-permit-required spaces, and employers that will choose to perform alternate entry into permit-required confined spaces without having a complete program. I think that's where employers get into tremendous trouble, because they decide, they make this election that we really don't enter these spaces, so we don't really need a complete program. They'll say their rescue component of the program will be when contractors enter the space, they have to provide their own rescue, and that's it. But when the space is reclassified, you know, it's just fraught with all kinds of problems. If the space is truly closed and it's locked and it's sealed and the employee can't enter the space, you know, it might be proper to say, okay, if contractors come to the site and they're going to work on the space, they have to have a entry, confined space entry program, and they have to have a rescue component to their program and all that. But that's not what we're finding. We're finding spaces that are classified back and forth from permit required to non-permit required, to alternate entry, all these things, or confined spaces that have chemical residues, which are not classifiable, by federal letters of interpretation, and employers are still doing it.
Great, thank you, Victor.